Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
This summer will mark the 40th anniversary of the only time a president of the United States had to resign from office. Richard Nixon, of course, in that statement in August 1974 because of Watergate. One of the journalists who closely covered Watergate and Nixon's downfall was Elizabeth Drew, then the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. These days, Drew contributes to the New York Review of Books and other publications, and she has re-released her Watergate classic, Washington Journal, reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's downfall with a new afterword based on 40 years of hindsight. Elizabeth Drew, welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, I'm glad to be with you again.
And this is your actual reporter's journal, entries almost day by day for the year leading up to Nixon's resignation. How much of this was in The New Yorker at the time?
All of it. So, all of it. Of course, not the afterword, which I wrote just this winter. The Random House wanted to publish the New Yorker pieces. I did a little bit, I said all that. I did a little bit at the beginning to set the scene because I didn't begin until Labor Day of 73, when it was clear to me that there could be real trouble for Nixon. This was kind of very wild thought at the time when William Shawn, the editor of The New Yorker, said, "Well, what are you thinking of writing about next?" I said, "Well, I don't know, but it seems to me that we might be changing vice presidents. Remember, Spiro Agnew was in big trouble, and maybe presidents within a year." This was an outlandish thought at the time. We didn't impeach in those days. We didn't even talk about it. The last one had been right after the Civil War. But it just... I go a lot, Brian, on instinct and smell, and it just smelled to me that way. And so we agreed I would write this journal. Now, it wasn't as if I came home and wrote a diary and just dumped the diary into the magazine. I mean, I had to write. I kept notes, and then I would write.
And then you would be edited, as The New Yorker does. But if it was happening today, since it did come out in this day-by-day form, Monday, this is happening, Tuesday, oh, now this happened, and I'm thinking this, and here's what this means. If it was happening today, you'd be a blogger and actually publish this journal as you were writing it. Do you wish you had been able to do that at the time?
Absolutely not. I needed time to think. I'm very glad I wasn't blogging, and I'm also very glad, with all due respect, and I watch a lot of it, I'm glad there wasn't cable. We'd have gone crazy. There was so much information flying about, and a lot of it was rumor, a lot of it was speculation, and you needed time to sort it out. People in it needed time to think. One of the things that concerns me now about the government is the people in there don't get time to think. They have to respond, instant response to everything. So, no, I didn't do every day, and I didn't do, you know, this morning I washed my hair, and then I did this and that. I was watching for the major events, trying to set them against, you know, a real life from time to time. But I didn't do my life, and it wasn't a diary. It was, I might take two or three days and then say, you know, this is what happened over this period. But it was writing. It wasn't just dumping it into the magazine.
And even back then, for historical perspective, I noticed that in your very first dated entry on September 4th, 1973, you comment on the unprecedented history that you're witnessing, but you write, quote, "The close view we get of these events in our newspapers, on our television screens, in our gossip may seem to reduce their magnitude." And I thought, ha, the media seemed fast and a trivializing force to you even in 1973.
Well, that's a really smart observation that you just made. I'd forgotten that, but it was. Well, look, we had a morning newspaper in Washington. We had a morning newspaper, then we had the Evening Star, and we waited for that. We had the Evening News, We waited for that, and we had the radio, but the radio wasn't producing that much. And we had our telephones calling each other or running into each other on the street, but we also just went around and did our work and had time to think.
Washington Journal, reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's downfall, the classic Watergate collected writings of Elizabeth Drew for The New Yorker from that last year before Richard Nixon resigned, now re-released, Elizabeth Drew with us. And there's a new section at the end of the book called An Afterword. And one thing that jumped right out at me from this afterword is that you basically call Richard Nixon a drunk and that people didn't realize the extent of it at the time. Did he have an alcohol problem while in the White House?
Yes, and I don't call him a drunk. He drank a lot. He drank a great deal. And he was sometimes, we had a little indication of that at the time. And when the tapes, the transcripts of the tape recordings that were going on in the White House came out, there was some sense that there was some incoherence. But we didn't know the degree of it. He was often incoherent, especially at night. He'd call aides at, 2 or 3 in the morning and say, "This is the president. I want you to fire the entire sixth floor of the State Department. This is an order. Slam." Then he'd pick up the phone again and say, "That order is not appealable. This is the president. Slam." So he had these aides on whom the country depended on deciding which ones of those orders should be carried out or not. Now, as I put in there, these were not the men of the greatest judgment who ever occupied a White House, because Nixon wanted people who would follow out his orders, and he said who were, who were tough and who were fighters like me, because to Nixon, this was all a fight. I also show in there that at the same time that he was drinking heavily, he was also taking a medication called Dilantin, which Jack Dreyfus, a big investor, gave to him, supposedly to ease depression, but it's never been approved of that. It's actually an anticonvulsive drug. But the effect of Dilantin, and I talked to medical people about this, is to enhance the effects of being drunk. So that the words were all the more slurred, the walking was a little uneasy.
And you wrote that Henry Kissinger sometimes referred to Nixon as, quote, "our drunken friend."
Right, or "our drunken friend has flipped out again." It's very scary. It's pretty clear. There's a lot of evidence that Nixon was drinking a lot on the eve of the invasion of Cambodia, which nobody, thought made a lot of sense. It did make a lot of sense at the time. And he and his one friend, he really wasn't big on friends. He was an awkward man and awkward with people, but his one friend, Bebe Rebozo, who Nixon treasured because they would go out fishing and Bebe wouldn't talk. And that's what Nixon wanted, or he had a yes man. And so Bebe Rebozo and the president were at Camp David, very drunk, calling in. And this is the testimony of White House people. It's not me. I'm not making this up. And he was ordering his aides to watch Patton. Or somebody called. They weren't sure if it was Rebozo or Nixon called up Kissinger and said, "Okay, Henry, it's your ass." This was the kind of, quote, thinking, unquote, that went into the invasion of Cambodia. And then he was so depressed after a very big night, what's called the Saturday Night Massacre, when he had kept firing attorneys general because they wouldn't fire Archibald Cox,
who was investigating him.
Who was investigating him and was demanding that he turn over the tapes, as ordered by the Supreme Court. And so Nixon got very depressed after that and retreated. And all we know is right after that, there was an order for a worldwide nuclear alert for no other apparent reason. So it was this sense that things were out of control.
Yeah. Much of the afterword is about Nixon's campaign to restore his reputation after he left office. And one detail of that, which, of course, very early on in that saga, was that he was reluctant to accept the pardon that President Ford offered him for all crimes that he might have been indicted for. What was Nixon's hesitation about?
That it would be seen as an admission of guilt. But they worked it out. They worked out the wording of it. That it seemed less that way. And there was a big uproar over that, as you may recall, Brian. I thought that Ford did the right thing. He had to get the country calmed down. And had there been, there were trials of Nixon's aides. All of his top aides went to jail, which tells you something. But had Nixon been on trial, it would have been, a total preoccupation. And Ford felt we've got to get the country moving. There was no deal. He wasn't doing it really out of compassion for Nixon so much as he was doing it for he had to get on and govern, and he had to get the country to start doing things again.
My guest is Elizabeth Drew, who meticulously covered the final year of the Nixon presidency for The New Yorker, and the collection of her reported works from that time is now re-released as the book Washington Journal, Reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's Downfall. 40 years ago this summer was the moment of the only resignation of a president of the United States. And you write about Nixon the man, what an awkward loner he was and with what desire for revenge. And you close the book by asking, do we have a screen adequate to prevent such a person from again gaining power? That is not clear. But I wonder about the focus on Nixon's psychology as opposed to screens against systemic abuse of power by any administration. Is the kind of man Nixon was the right bottom line?
I'm not sure I'm clear about that, Brian, but we didn't know that there would be an abuse of power until he got in there. We can't know that ahead of time, but we can know about a type of personality. Now, you may notice I didn't use any psychobabble in this book, but we knew the following, and it became clearer later on. Nixon confused opponents with enemies. He saw enemies all around him. That's what brought him down. And then his White House hired these, they were called plumbers, but they were really kind of stumble bums, thank heavens, and they messed up everything they did. A lot of them were alumni of the Bay of Pigs, and they were still angry that Kennedy hadn't provided them with air support. So Nixon got them convinced that they were all fighting communism together and that they were helping him. One of the more, to me, alarming things about this whole period was the Nixon White House took it upon itself to try to determine the nominee of the opposition party. Now, whether they succeeded or not, you can't say, but they got what they wanted. They were most afraid, first, of Ted Kennedy. So Nixon had one of these goons follow Kennedy around to try to, he was always trying to get the goods on people. Then they wanted to get rid of Muskie. They were most afraid of him. Now, they sent in people to mess up his events. This is, it's a very strong word, but I wrote that this is on the way to fascism. When you start having bully boys mess up other people's, campaign events, when you set about to make sure that they don't get the nomination, this is very scary stuff.
And that was the context of the Watergate break-in. It was a break-in at Democratic National Committee headquarters. But looking at some of the presidential scandals since Watergate, and we're going to be out of time in a minute, America has too often had to ask the question, is this scandal worse than Watergate? So Iran-Contra, where Reagan and his people sold arms to Iran, of all places, contrary to U.S. law, just to break another law by funding a military insurgency in Central America that Congress had explicitly barred from Americans' taxpayer funding. And then there were the Bush-Cheney scandals that Elizabeth Holtzman from the Watergate-era House Judiciary Committee wrote up as articles of impeachment in a book of her own for breaking U.S. law. Do we remember Watergate with too high a priority as
no.
opposed to a relatively two-bit break-in when these other things really were much worse because they subverted U.S. policy?
The term Watergate got applied to a large pattern and practice of activity. Wiretapping journalists and your own aides, breaking in not just to the Watergate, but far more serious, and Nixon knew this, the psychiatrist's office of Daniel Ellsberg, who had released the Pentagon Papers, a plan which Nixon ordered, fortunately somebody called it off, to blow up, start a fire in the Brookings Institution in order to get at some papers that they thought two people had who had worked on the Pentagon Papers. Well, they didn't have them. There were no files in the psychiatrist's office. But that's not the point. The point is there were no boundaries. There were no limits on what they would do, paying off of the people who had broken into the Watergate, finding, you know, shaking down people in order to pay them off. No, there nothing has remotely come close to it.
Do you think, 30 seconds, if Nixon had been not forced to resign, that any of Reagan or Bush or Clinton for lying under oath about his sex scandal would have forced any of those presidents to?
No. This, you know, the word impeachment is tossed around so easily now. And that's really unfortunate. This was a very serious, it was arrived at in a bipartisan way after very serious consideration by the House Judiciary Committee. It came from the center, not from the left, and not from the right, who opposed everything. There was a national consensus that very carefully arrived at. Now, on the Iran-Contra, there was a close question as to whether to proceed against Reagan, but the committee that investigated it decided the country had just been through an impeachment. They didn't want to upset it again. But I would still say, while I covered that, gavel to gavel with Judy Woodruff, it was very, very serious. But it was not the pattern, the widespread pattern of criminal and unconstitutional and irresponsible activity. We had the question, Brian, of whether the Constitution was going to hold, whether the president was accountable. This was very, very, very serious stuff, and nothing that I know of has come close.
Elizabeth Drew, the collection of her writings for The New Yorker in the last year of the Nixon presidency, released as a book, really re-released. This has been out before. It's a seminal book on Watergate. Call Washington Journal, Reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's Downfall. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, what's the third language in your home state? Behind English and Spanish, a surprisingly diverse map. Stay with us.